There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. Well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in the noose. Any minute now I'm expecting all hell to break loose. People are crazy and time is strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. This place ain't doing me any good. I'm in the wrong town, should be in Hollywood. Just a second there I thought I saw something. Gonna take dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcut, gonna dress in drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to prove. Lot of water under the bridge, lot of other stuff too. Don't get up, gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and time's strange. I'm locked in tight, my reign. Used to care, but things have changed. I've been walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Some days are too hard to touch. The human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first woman I meet. Putting her in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and times are strange. Locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Just don't show it. You can hurt someone, not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. I'm in love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. James and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager, make that mistake. Some people are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed. Thank you.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today is the 11th of June, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio a couple minutes after 8 a.m. Arizona time. Your mind is your primary weapon. Now, I'm not sure what's cooking with this phone connection, but in the lead-up, it dropped a call three times, so seems to be either working on the phone at 8 o'clock in the morning or something. As a similar thing happened the other day on the micro effect. But anyway, I'll monitor the signal from this end, and we'll just go from there. Let's see where we at. Pick back up our lesson of insurgency, talking about Mao Zedong and the transition and the interpretation of the principles of guerrilla war by General Vo Nguyen Giap. And thanks for taking the time to tune in today to Liberty Tree Radio. Thanks for helping keep LTR on the air. Have quite a bit of border information. If you would like to call in, the telephone is 712-432-0900. And then the room number access code is 957-464, and then the pound sign. Now, a lot of people know that information. I think the website is libertytreeradio.4mg.com. I'm sure if you type into your search engine, Liberty Tree Radio, it'll come up. And the telephone number is there. And the nice thing about it is instead of having to carry a larger device or sit at a desktop and listen to the show on Liberty Tree Radio, you can also listen on your telephone that way at 712-432-0900. And then the access code is 957-464 in the pound sign. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can push *6 and that will unmute your phone. And you come right up. No board operator to run through or hoops or anything like that. I just heard a little blurbs on the radio this morning. A Army soldier from the 3rd Special Forces Group from Chandler, Arizona. His name was Alex Conrad. Died yesterday in some far-off place or halfway around the world. Alex Conrad, 3rd Special Forces, Chandler, Arizona. As always, we send this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Those first two words phonetically, Alpha, Lima, Tango, Hotel, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. And also have a similar broadcast on the micro effect on Thursday and Friday every week at 8 to 10 Arizona time. So that's kind of what I have for the schedule for today. Let's see, and at the bottom of the hour I'll cover over some information about Bob Miner, and I'm sure your people are following that saga as it is. One of the websites that I go to frequently for information what's cooking down in south of the border, Mexico and Central America, South America, is insightcrime.org. They have some pretty good information there. And sometimes it's maybe a little uncomfortable. I kind of wonder how it is that the mainstream news media here in the United States, they've been running quite a bit of the caravan news and the poor migrants and stuff and all that. Great big, there was some transgender from a guy that wanted to be a girl, but from in, I think he was in Guatemala or El Salvador or something like that, and come up with the caravan, and now they want to come into the United States, and it was a front page above the fold, and inside the newspaper it ran on two separate pages, and it's like, oh, well, we don't feel safe, and because our gender is male, but we put us into these holding areas with other males, and then we get beat up, and oh, and then we just need to have our own special place, and I don't know, but I just find it odd that they're constantly running these kinds of stories, and it's usually written by somebody with the last name of Gonzalez or Sandoval or, you know, something like that, but they hardly ever run any stories of insidecrime.org. U.S. funds for abusive El Salvadoran police cast doubts on vetting. 31 May 2018, a new report says that United States funded an elite unit of El Salvador's national police that committed egregious abuses of force, including extrajudicial killings, underscoring flaws in the North American nation's process of vetting units receiving security assistance. The Elite Special Reaction Force, that FES of El Salvador's National Civil Police, received significant U.S. funding despite allegedly being responsible for the murder of 43 suspected gang members through the first 6 months of 2017. Sources consulted confirmed that the elite FES unit was the recipient of an unknown portion of the more than $140 million in security assistance that the United States provided to El Salvador in the last two years. The FES was disbanded earlier this year and replaced with another specialized force known as the Specialized Police Tactical Unit, Unidad Tactica Especializada Policia, the UTEP, 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 also known as the Jaguars. And, many former FES members were never investigated for the alleged abuses and joined the Jaguar Elite Force, which also received U.S. funding. In August 17, an investigation by the Salvadoran magazine Factum first identified four FES agents who allegedly committed at least three extrajudicial executions, amongst other crimes. The investigation also revealed that the officers in question were using social media. Just checking to see if we're still here. Social media to coordinate and discuss extrajudicial killings, as well as how to stage a crime scene to make an execution look like a confrontation, amongst other things. However, officials in El Salvador at the time failed to take decisive action in response to the allegations. And in the wake of the report, Deputy Police Commissioner Carla Andrade rejected the claim that members of the country's police force executed suspected gang members. In the first place, the National Civil Police does not execute gang members, and I want to emphasize that the police do not execute gang members. They don't execute anyone. That is not the correct term, because that is not our constitutional mission, Andrade said at a press conference. Spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador said that the U.S. government takes the allegations extremely serious and that it has consistently expressed concerns regarding allegations, security force abuse, the need for accountability, and the critical role of rights-respecting security forces in a healthy democracy. Oh, boy. He said, she said. Yeah, classic. InsideCrime.org, 31 May 2018, in El Salvador, a thin line between community policing and vigilantism. Authorities in El Salvador are keen to expand a much-praised local policing model believed to have helped two rival communities tackle bloody gang control. But a visit to the areas revealed a murky combination of factors behind the security gains, including indications of vigilantism. On a dirt road leading to the villages of this place and that place and the municipality of another place that's hard to pronounce, some 80 kilometers east of the capital, San Salvador, a rusty checkpoint barrier blocks an unpaved path cutting through the countryside. Uncultivated fields sprawl on either side of the dirt road in one direction to the foot of a mountain forest looming in the distance that once served as a hideout for guerrilla insurgents who fought in El Salvador's civil war in the 1980s and early 90s. A few kilometers back stands the landmark Golden Bridge, one of the biggest and most impressive engineering feats in El Salvador until it was famously blown up in 1981 by a commando from the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front, the FMLN, the guerrilla group that later became the governing political party. The civil war is long over, and the FMLN flags flying above so many of the rural households here now represent a nonviolent political movement rather than the armed revolution, a sign of how far the country has come in securing peace. But the war in this region gave way to another conflict, this time between the MS-13 and Barrio 18 gangs, as well as the state security forces, which turned the area once again into a battleground. Juan Jose Leyva, a sturdy man in his mid-50s who is an officer of the municipal police, remembers that the presence of the gangs began expanding in 2012, and it says here it's an 11-page article, and that was just a couple of pages, so that's what it is. we've got, this one's from BorderlandBeat.com, 31 May 2018, Latin America must make drugs legal to stop killing, says United Nations chief. Countries in Latin America should consider legalizing drugs to ease the human costs linked to the deadly trade, a United Nations chief has said. Alicia Barcina, who heads the Santiago, Chile-based Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, said that countries in the region needed to look at drastic measures to tackle the trade, which kills tens of thousands of people each year. It's time to seriously consider legalizing drugs, she told a Latin American forum in Paris. I'm going to be very proactive. Who would drug legalization be good for? Latin America and the Caribbean, for God's sake, because the illegality is what's killing people, said Barcina, who is from Mexico. Mexico is a hub through which cocaine is smuggled from Peru, Colombia, and Bolivia to reach the United States. 2017, it had its deadliest year on record with 29,168 reported murders, higher than the murder rate at the height of the Mexican drug war in 2011, according to government data. On Sunday, Rosalinda Garcia, the wife of top drug lord Nemesio Oseguera, known as El Mencho, was arrested on charges of laundering funds for his New Generation Jalisco cartel, which is blamed for heroin shipments to the U.S. Oseguera is Mexico's most wanted drug lord after Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was extradited to the United States last year for trial. The U.S. State Department is offering an award of up to $5 million for information leading to his arrest or conviction. CBP.gov/newsroom, 31 May 2018, Nogales CBP officer seized $657,000 in hard drugs, Tucson, Arizona. U.S. Customs Border Protection officers at Arizona's Port of Nogales apprehended four U.S. citizens and a Mexican national involved in connection with separate failed attempts to smuggle more than 84 pounds of heroin, methamphetamine, and cocaine into the United States over the weekend. Officers working at the Morley pedestrian crossing referred a 20-year-old woman for further inspection as she attempted to enter on Friday morning. A search of the woman led to the discovery of less than a pound of heroin worth more than $7,500, which the subject had taped in her crotch. Saturday afternoon, officers at the Dennis B. Cassini crossing referred a 51-year-old man for further inspection of his Hyundai sedan. A search by officers led to discovery of more than 26 pounds of cocaine worth almost $298,000 within the vehicle's floor and seats. Officers at the DeConcini crossing referred a 40-year-old Mexican national man for additional inspection of his Chevrolet SUV. Cocaine canine alert led officers to find almost 46 pounds of meth wrapped around the inside of the tires. Drugs were valued at more than $137,000. Borderlandbeat.com, 31 May 2018, Tamaulipas, another journalist has been killed in Mexico, the sixth this year. As a reporter for the Mexican newspaper Excelsior, Hector Gonzalez Antonio frequently chronicled the violence engulfing his home state of Tamaulipas. Recent topics included one shootout that interrupted an Easter parade, another that killed six innocent bystanders, and a group of people searching for disappeared loved ones. In January, Gonzalez wrote about the killing of the Tamaulipas journalist who was stabbed to death while waiting with his family at a stoplight. This week, Gonzalez became another victim, what is he once described as the crisis of insecurity in Tamaulipas. His corpse was found Tuesday on a dirt road in the state capital of Ciudad Victoria. Has been bludgeoned to death, according to the state prosecutor's office, which was not discussed possible motives. Never ends. So we take away their guns and they beat them to death with a baseball bat. So we make drugs legal and then they just start stealing fuel and running prostitution and human smuggling. And on the bright side, I have an article, I'll get to it further on up, most likely not today, but next, when I come back up on Thursday and Friday, on the micro effect. But this one's also from insightcrime.org. Don't expect nuanced view of crime when Rambo takes on Mexican cartel. 6 June 2018, the venerable action hero John Rambo is plotting a return to the silver screen and has taken his talent for mayhem and vengeance to Mexico. While fans may find the film entertaining, it's unlikely to present a nuanced look at the country's organized crime problem. So Rambo's coming back and he's going to get the drug cartels. I guess it's something about a friend of his daughter was kidnapped by the cartel, so he goes down in there, Mr. One Man Army, and going to get the daughter back, take her away. There was also another one here, and I saw it, and somebody had sent me an email with it up in the local newspaper here in Arizona, but I usually check my email first, and then when I went to Borderland Beat of about a family, Joanne Butler and Ray Ball, and they were down in Mexico, and they died. Somebody's trying to steal their boat, and it looked like they went out there and told Jose that this wasn't his boat, that it was our boat, and then something about a baseball bat, and so it looked like they had confronted him out where the boat was moored, and he drove them back into the house and killed them, killed the dog, killed everything. And so, and of course, nobody saw nothing, nobody heard nothing. And it's in the same place that I covered an article back in, I think it was January. Now it's odd in the one newspaper deal that it's, you know, Jose Valdez Garcia, the top politician in the area, goes, "Oh, I just don't know what happened. This is the first time that anything has happened like this. I just don't know." But I guess they like them Yankee tourist dollars, so of course they're not going to report on that. Kind of the same way that there's not a whole lot of reporting about what's going on in Nicaragua. I covered that, I think it was last Monday. I know I covered it last week on the micro effects, but I'm pretty sure spread it across the board. And I also came up on the afternoon intel report, I think it was like Tuesday or Wednesday, that there was some phone problems and it was just Don, and it started talking about what the issue was that was going on in El Salvador and, or not, excuse me, in Nicaragua. And I'd like to say thanks to the people that sent me the supporting articles of about what's going on down there. And it's kind of interesting. It's not that it's not being reported on, but it's the lack of reporting. I find it odd, just as the example of about the transgender that want to come up here from Central America to the United States so they can feel safe, but there's not a peep out of the Arizona Republic, which is connected to USA Today, that they won't say anything about what's going on in people getting bludgeoned to death and the violence that's occurring and the violent protests that are going on in Nicaragua. Now, I see we're down at the bottom of the hour. Should hear the music maybe in the next minute or two. But just kind of a quick review. The other day we had started talking about colonial war and the French experience, comparing the strategy and the tactics of Vo Nguyen Diap and how the Viet Minh won in Indochina. So we have to ask, how do the laws of revolutionary war laid down by Mao Zedong apply to the remaining colonies of the great powers? But the answer is implicit in the historical record, because during the two decades following World War II, no colonial war has been lost by a colonial people once entered into it. Malaya and the Philippines are the only apparent exceptions, but not real ones. And in the more fortunate instances, the colonial powers have ceded their authority in good time, bowing before the wind of history. And the revolutionary action was wrestled the colonies away from the extortion of terror and civil disorder, as an example of in Cyprus and Morocco, or by a clear force of arms as in Algeria and Indonesia. Now, the struggle in South Vietnam, it lasted from 1946 when Ho Chi Minh took up arms against a French invasion, and the surrender, and had to do with the Japanese and the British and the Chinese and their forces coming in after World War II. And then that struggle went on until 1954, when the country was petitioned at the 17th parallel under the terms of an international government reached at Geneva following the fall of the French stronghold at Dien Bien Phu. Now, the outcome of the war represented something less than a complete victory for the communist Viet Minh, but it nevertheless spelled absolute defeat for the French and marked the end of the French rule in Vietnam. Now, the bulk of the 500,000-man French Expeditionary Corps remained intact. They had 172,000 casualties in 8 years, but its spirit was broken, and the political compromise that followed failed to disguise the fact that the French arms had met a defeat in the field at the hands of what had been considered a ragtag native army that could be smashed in 10 weeks. I see we're at the bottom here, so if we're going to pause for the cause here, but I can continue. I'm just kind of glad. Let me check the phone here to make sure we're still on the air. Yeah. It's no fun being an illegal alien. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Thank you for taking the time to tune in to Liberty Tree Radio. Okay, everybody, repeat after me. It's no fun being an illegal alien. Well, good morning. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Today is the 11th of June, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 9:35, 37 or so, Arizona time. 8:30. Right. Okay, not 9. And we've been covered over a little bit of about the colonial war and the French experience and comparing the writings of Mao Zedong and General Giap in the Viet Minh defeat of the French. I'd like to say thanks for taking the time to tune in today. Hope this information is beneficial to you. Covered on the first 30 minutes of the broadcast, talked about the border news, things are going on down in Mexico and Central America. If you'd like to call Bob Miner and leave some words of encouragement, his telephone is 701-251-2365, 701-251-2365. Message will come on and ask you if you'd like to speak to him directly or if you'd like to purchase a phone card, and then it'll ask you to enter in the first three digits of his last name, and it's M-I-N, translates out to 646. And then it'll say, it'll leave your message after the beep, and, you know, and who the message is for. So, and you'll only have about 10 seconds or so to do that. If you'd like to call into today's broadcast, we got about 20 minutes left. The telephone here at Liberty Tree Radio is 712-432-0900. And the room number is 957-464 in the pound sign. And when come up, then the phone will be muted and you can unmute your phone by pressing *6. And let's see, the email address is altabeeb762@hotmail.com, altabeeb762 at hotmail.com. And also the show is dedicated to Lily Grace Antoinette. And also we'll have some more insurgency border information on the micro effect on Thursday and Friday. We have 2 hours each day at 8 to 10 Arizona time. So we have a very limited amount of time here on Liberty Tree Radio to try to get as much information out as possible. When I left off, we were talking about the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. And during the 8 years of battle, the Viet Minh, they passed from a movement of scattered guerrilla bands operating in a company or even platoon size to a regular army of mobile divisions. And they were armed with light artillery and equal in organization and the fighting ability to the best that the French could put in the field. Now, the final phase, the strategic offensive, and that's described by Mao, was fought by that army. By far the greater part of the long campaign was guerrilla warfare. Now, the definition of guerrilla warfare offered by General Vo Nguyen Giap, the victor at Dien Bien Phu, it concurs with Mao's, and even the rhetoric is the same. And if we have a good understanding of the Sun Tzu, and, you know, we make a noise in the east, attack in the west. When they're weak, we attack. When they're strong, we retreat, et cetera, et cetera. But according to General Giap, a guerrilla war is a form of fighting by the masses of a weak and badly equipped country against an aggressive army with better equipment and techniques. This is the way of fighting a revolution. Guerrillas rely on heroic spirit to triumph over modern weapons, avoiding the enemy when he is stronger and attacking him when he is weaker. now scattering, now regrouping, now wearing out, now exterminating the enemy. They are determined to fight everywhere so that whenever the enemy goes, he is submerged in a sea of armed people who hit back at him, thus undermining his spirit and exhausting his forces. Fortunately for the cause, Ziap had absorbed the practical wisdom as well as the political rhetoric of Mao, and is on pretty solid ground when General Ziap wrote, in addition to scattering to wear out the enemy, it's necessary to regroup big armed forces in favorable situations to achieve supremacy and attack at a given point in time to annihilate the enemy. Successes in many small fights added together gradually wear out the enemy's manpower while little by little strengthening our forces. The main goal of the fight must be destruction of the enemy manpower over our manpower. Our own manpower should not be exhausted from trying to keep or occupy land. Ziap's definition of the objectives is purely military, but in a colonial situation, the political effects of the guerrilla war are less important, perhaps, than in the war against the native government of a semi-colonial country such as Cuba. Now, certainly, they are less important in the case of the nation defending itself against an invader, as an example of French rule after World War II. But this is to speak of the effects of the struggle on the government morale and on the world opinion. And clearly, the primary political task of militating the people retained the same vital importance in Vietnam as anywhere, and a fact which Ziap himself recognized. Now, writing of the first years of the long guerrilla campaign, he says in the beginning, quote, there appeared a tendency not to take into due account the part played by the political work, and the political workers did not yet grasp the fact that the main task was political education and ideological leadership, end quote. Now, later on, the terror was perceived and due attention was paid to the key political problem, and that was of uniting the nation in all its social sectors and joining all ethnic groups in a multinational country against foreign domination. And the party strove hard to avail itself of the favorable opportunities to push the people into the struggle. Ziap relates with considerable candor, and he wrote again that, quote, the National United Front was to be a vast assembly of all the forces capable of being united, neutralizing all those which could be neutralizing, and dividing all those it was possible to divide. Now, we covered quite a bit extensively in what was going on in the political aspect in Vietnam a while back, maybe a year or ago. It was almost excruciating, as in the detail that we had presented on the methods that Uncle Ho had employed and General Ziap and the connection with Mao, and how that they would infiltrate a group that already existed, a political group, but they would stay in the background. Now, if the group was successful in their endeavor, then the communist would emerge and claim victory. But if their cause failed, then the communist would just leave and then let the people that were out in front of the pre-existing group, let them take the blame for the failure of what it was. And oftentimes that Uncle Ho would resort to, if he couldn't co-opt the people, he would just eliminate them. Now, this is the part that I'm about insurgency, about the strategic terrain, which is the people, because the early neglect of the peasantry, and that was quickly rectified in the face of the realities of the war in the peasant country and the agrarian reform with the slogan they came up with, land to the tillers, and that became a rallying cry of the revolution. Can't remember the Alamo. Now, again, quoting from Ziap, the enemy of the Vietnamese nation was aggressive imperialism, which had to be overthrown. But as the imperialists had long since joined with the feudal landlords, the anti-imperialist struggle definitely could not be separated from anti-feudal action. Now, on the other hand, in a backward colonial country such as ours, where the peasants make up the majority of the population, a people's war is essentially a peasants' war under the leadership of the working class. A general mobilization of the whole people is, therefore, neither more nor less than the mobilization of the rural masses. But the failure to form a broad popular front, especially one including the religious sects, notably the Buddhists, cost the Viet Minh dearly in South Vietnam at the beginning of the struggle. And we've also noted that Ho Chi Minh's guerrilla forces had taken virtual control of the country with the surrender of the Japanese occupying force of World War II. Now, in part, because of the defection of the religious sects, the French armored forces landed in South Vietnam met little opposition. Within a few months, they held much of what was then called Cochin China, Vietnam's southernmost state, of which Saigon is the capital. Now, only a lack of manpower, they had 40,000 troops under the commander of General Leclerc, and that comprised the initial expeditionary force, and that prevented them from seizing the flatlands of Annam and Tonkin as well. Now, as the French observer, Dr. Bernard Fall, wrote the book, Street Without Joy and Two Vietnams, he remarked that the French objectives in Indochina in 1946, quote, envisioned little more than a campaign of colonial reconquest along classic lines like Marshal Luttey's campaign against Abd el-Krim's Rif Kabyles in the 1920s, end quote. Now, the method chosen was the so-called oil slick technique, and it involved the establishment of strong points in the region from which pacification forces would spread out to cut the countryside into small squares and then to comb each square on a grid, working from the outside until the rebel forces within the net were finally brought to close quarter and exterminated. Now, it is, in effect, a police method, but the trouble was that Leclerc did not have a sufficient number of the policemen for the campaign, and that was the combing without which the whole plan fell to pieces. Now, the French campaign fit a pattern typically of what must be expected to happen when regular military forces try to combat guerrillas as though they are a conventional military enemy, or on the other hand, treat them as mere roving bandits to be dispersed by flying columns and picked off one by one. Leclerc armored columns rushed in, seized the major roads and the important crossroad towns, and felt that they had made a successful start, since they met little determined resistance at any point. But what they failed to realize initially was that although they controlled the roads, they were fighting an enemy that had no need of the roads, being without transport or heavy artillery to move. They seized strong points, but those strong points commanded nothing, since the enemy was not stationary, but fluid and offered no contest for the strong points or for the territory. Kind of similar techniques, tactics of what Lawrence had employed over in the Hejaz in World War I. And it's kind of interesting that, General Ziap had met with the French general, and a new book had been published, and it was called Seven Pillars of Wisdom by Colonel T.E. Lawrence, and he had asked to borrow the book, and the French general had said that he hadn't finished reading it. So Ziap had studied extensively Napoleon, and was really interested also in the tactics of Lawrence of Arabia. So anyway, when it comes down to it, so what? The French controlled the roads. Well, the guerrillas passed safely in the jungle and the rice paddies on either side at a distance of 100 yards unseen. And the French held the towns. The enemy had no design on the towns, because where the French were fighting to control the national territory, and that meant occupying it, the guerrillas were interested in only winning the population. Now, this is the essential contrast between conventional war and guerrilla war. The army fights to occupy the territory, the roads, the strategic heights, the vital areas, and the guerrilla fights to control the people, without whose cooperation the land is useless to its possessor. Now, the oil slick pattern, better for catching bandits than for fighting guerrillas, might actually have been used to some advantage in Indochina had the French commanded more troops to devote to the campaign. But in a revolutionary situation, moreover, one in which the foreign troops opposed native guerrillas, the suppression campaign could only work locally. What is the method of preventing new outbreaks short of exterminating the entire population, you may ask? And that's yet to be discovered. The Vietnamese casualties that fall before the French were very high, and the death toll high during 8 years of bitter internal war. And Dr. Fall estimates the Viet Minh casualties at three times those of the French Union forces, putting the latter at 172,000. Yet there's strong evidence that the great bulk of the native casualties were not the guerrillas but the civilians, innocent bystanders. So the French drive was doomed to failure. The country was too big, the population was too great, and there was too much natural cover for the guerrillas. The French forces were far too small for an effort that required a minimum ratio of 10 soldiers for every guerrilla, and many very well needed 20 or 100 in a land where every native was a potential guerrilla fighter. So the Viet Minh troops were organized on three levels, according to the pattern established in China and used elsewhere. So at the top were the so-called Cook Lock Regulars, and they were the permanent guerrilla fighters who could be employed strategically wherever needed and who carried the main campaign. Now, when the insurgent forces were concentrated for a major strike, now beneath the Cook Lock were the regional guerrillas who fought only in their own zones and could always return to their civilian character as peasants and workers if they were hard-pressed. Now, on the bottom level were the village militia, the Duk-Kik, and the guerrillas by night and peasants by day. And they carried out a limited assignment, sabotaging a bridge here, ambushing a patrol there, mining the roads, carrying messages or funds, and fading back into their farms and villages at the first approach of the military opposition. Now, at the first shots of the imperialist invasion, writes General Ziap, General Leclerc estimated that the reoccupation of Vietnam would be a military walkover. When encountering resistance in the south, the French generals considered it weak and temporary and stuck to their opinion that it would take 10 weeks at most to occupy and pacify the whole of South Vietnam. So the question is, why did the French colonialists make such an estimate? And that was because they considered that to meet their aggression, they must be an army, and it was not possible for them to understand the fundamental and decisive fact that the Vietnamese army, although weak materially, was a people's army in provoking hostilities, and the colonialists had alienated the whole nation. And indeed, the whole Vietnamese nation, the entire Vietnamese people, rose against them. And unable to grasp that profound truth, the French generals, who believed in an easy victory, went instead to certain defeat. Now, allowing for rhetorical exaggeration, there's still much in what Ziap says. Now, the French forces concentrating on strong points and other objectives of a conventional warfare strategy, they found themselves submerged in a sea of armed people. Now, the arms, in the main, came from the French Expeditionary Corps, which, says Ziap, became unwittingly the supplier of the Vietnam People's Army with French, even U.S. arms. And also about the organization of the resistance, because General Ziap notes that it was primarily political and only secondarily militarily. And I'll quote from him, "Our party advocated that to launch a people's war, it was necessary to have three kinds of armed forces. It attached great importance to the building and development of self-defense units and guerrilla units. Militias were set up everywhere, thanks to the funding of the People's Administration everywhere in the countryside and the existence of party branches in every place. The militias spread far and wide and the people rose to fight. In the enemy's rear, guerrilla units, in coordination with the regular army, scattered and wore out the enemy, nailed them to their bases so that our regular army could launch mobile fighting to annihilate them. They turned the enemy's rear into our front line and built guerrilla bases as starting points for our regular army's offensive, right in the heart of the enemy. They protected the people and their property, fought the enemy and kept up production, and frustrated the enemy's schemes to use war to feed war and Vietnamese to fight Vietnamese. In the free zones, guerrilla units effectively fought the enemy and kept watch on traitors. They were effective instruments for the local administration and local party. At the time, they were the shock force in production, transport, and supply. And although combat and work, the guerrilla units became an inexhaustible and precious source of replenishment for the regular army, supplying with men and officers who were politically well-educated and rich in fighting experience." End quote. Now, both sides made serious mistakes in the early phases of the eight-year struggle. The French, for their part, devoted a full 5 months of 1947 to the fruitless task of attempting to capture Ho Chi Minh and his staff, thinking in this way to cut short the war. Now, the effort was wasted. And even if they had captured Ho, it probably would have affected not very much effect on the course of war, and the outcome of which depended not on individual military genius, but on a strategy dictated by the political military situation, and a strategy that any communist leader, aware of the lessons of China, would have applied. Now, here it can be well observed that, to a great extent, the guerrilla fights as they do because they must. Their situation determines their course of action, and lacking the heavy weapons and the disciplined divisions to which to fight a conventional military campaign, and they are confined, as Clausewitz put it, to nibbling at the edges of the opposing army and fighting in the enemy's rear area, materially unable to face a military decision or to listen to the WHO. And that sounds like we've come up to the end of today's broadcast. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll see you on The Micro Effect at 8 o'clock Arizona time on Thursday, and we'll continue with our lesson of the War of the Fleet, and your mind is your primary weapon. Thanks for being with us again today.
We're in the band. And then